Welcome to In It to Win It. This is Steve Barton, and I am here with Justin Hune of Uranium Insider. Justin, thank you for coming on the show.
Pleasure to be here, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Yes, yes. Let me start off by saying we are not financial advisors. Do not take this as financial advice. This is just what Justin and I are doing. And we're not looking and saying, maybe this whole inflation thing will handle itself, right? We're not doing that.
Right.
Yes. Okay. So you got into uranium way before I did, probably 5 or 6 years ago, right? What led you into this space and how did you get fascinated by it and what brought you to where you are today?
Well, it was one of the first contrarian investments that I ever made. I primarily had been a trend following trader, a momentum trader, technicals only kind of thing. For the first about 5 years of my investing slash trading career, if you want to call it. And in 2016, I was listening to a podcast to Frank Curzio's Wall Street Unplugged, and he had Jordan Trimble from Sky Harbor Resources on as a guest. And they were talking about how the uranium sector has been mired in a long bear market after Fukushima, got into all the details of that. That podcast actually came out right about at the bottom of the price of uranium. It was $18 a pound. It was late 2016. And at the time, it was way, way below the cost of production, the average cost of production, let alone the marginal cost of production. So you have this this sector that sentiment was slowly kind of shifting from being very negative, coming around to a very slow at the time recognition of it, of nuclear being a positive solution for clean energy. And then you had the underlying commodity, the fuel for nuclear, uranium, trading $18 a pound with the marginal cost of production in the 50s. So they're saying, okay, so this price absolutely must rise at some point, but we don't know when that point is. And at the time, there was still a lot of above ground mobile inventory of uranium that came from years of oversupply. And of course, you know, even at the very bottom for the commodity, that was like the ultimate contrarian bet because everybody hated it. Yet it was a sector that was set to grow. And for me, it was just kind of, I don't know, this light bulb just went off where instead of the type of trading I'd been doing, which was zero fundamentals, literally just looking at the charts and trading on momentum and trading on chart pattern breakouts and volume, et cetera. Just and that was working well enough. Yeah, purely technicals. Yeah. In fact, the guy who kind of took me under his wing and taught me how to trade on technicals basically told me that he wanted to know absolutely nothing about the company or even the sector of the stock that he was trading. The less fundamentals he knew about it, the better. He wanted an unbiased view of the chart, period. And over time, I had started to realize that if I knew something about the company or about the sector, it helped my conviction to take that trade. Even if I stuck with my own rules for being stopped out on taking a trade, I still, so for example, if a stock just gapped up on big volume and I knew why, then that oftentimes led to a higher chance of that being a successful trade over time.
Yeah.
And so just because there was something fundamental driving that technical breakout, it wasn't just a random thing. It wasn't just traders piling into it, following volume based on nothing. It was something underlying that was moving that chart. And so that sort of led me to kind of appreciate the fundamental side of things. And then uranium came to me and is like, wow, this is totally different. Now I can learn about this sector slowly. There's no time pressure. Eventually this will turn. I don't know when. That was, to me, was extremely low stress. And I just started to build my knowledge on the sector because, well, I mean, honestly, originally the inspiration came from the obvious outperformance of uranium in the previous bull market relative to most other commodities or indexes. And, you know, investors made historical returns in that bull market. It was epic proportions. And so the potential of that repeating, or at least even coming close to repeating, was very attractive. But then the more I learned about it, the more I just, you know, slowly became a unabashed nuclear advocate. It clearly is an unappreciated clean source of baseload energy. And it's taken, you know, 5 years really for that sentiment to to turn to what feels like a global majority is in support at this point, especially in countries where it was definitely not the majority in support in the past. So that would be a number of European countries, the United States in particular. So it's kind of turned into this investment that just kind of, it's a feel-good investment. I feel good about placing my money in this thing that I believe in. And it's also just a sector that punches above its weight. I mean, when it moves, it really moves. It's very volatile to the upside and the downside, but it's so small. You know, it's less than 40 billion total market cap for the publicly traded equities in the uranium space, less than 70 companies. And so when a lot of capital flows into it, the stocks really move hard. And so between 2016 and 2021, long story short, I just continued to learn. I started a Twitter account called Uranium Insider based on essentially recognizing that the little amount of research that I had done still put me in this small group of maybe a couple of dozen people that understood this thesis better than everybody else. And I just wanted to be in that group. And I wanted to share ideas and I wanted to connect. And Twitter's an amazing place for investing community. And that just kind of snowballed over the years. I started a free newsletter in 2018 and built up a bit of a following there. And eventually it was, I just, as the sector had warmed up, people were coming to me, hey, you really should do a paid thing. I would pay you for you to tell me what stocks to buy in the space, et cetera. And it just turned naturally into what we're doing now, which is the Uranium Insider Pro newsletter. It's a paid service. Been doing that for 2.5 years. We've done pretty well. So we started that August 2019 and we're up about 450% total portfolio since then. And we did 122% last year, which is really good overall portfolio. Down a little bit this year so far, but it's all right. The sector is kind of forming a base here. And yeah, it's been an amazing experience.
Yeah, I found you on Silver Chartist. I'm a member there. And
awesome. I love Steve.
It's pretty cool because as I was looking through your guys' portfolio, I'm like, oh, I got that. I haven't even heard of this company. I got to get this guy on the show. And you mentioned something I want to ask about. What do you mean when you say you found uranium at $18, but it was more than that to produce it? How is that possible? Why would it be cheaper than what it actually costs to do it?
Because there was such a vast amount of oversupply after Fukushima. So essentially what happened, and uranium is really unique. So it follows a lot of similar fundamentals as other commodities in these boom and bust cycles, where you have a rising price that typically overshoots the average cost of production based on speculation and the fact that there's an undersupply. And that rising price brings on new supply. The market gets flooded with new supply and the price falls. And this happens in basically every commodity. What's unique with uranium is it takes an extremely long time to bring uranium production online, especially new production. If it's a mine that's produced before it's on care and maintenance, that can come online faster. But even that is, you know, 12 to 24 months to bring an idled mine into production. And we're talking for to go from a discovery to development to actual production. I mean, it can be decades depending on the jurisdiction. So when you have a price overshoot like we did in 2007, it went up to $134 a pound. Then it crashed back down and started to recover. And then we had Fukushima. So I think it recovered up into like $70 a pound, 75 around that range. And after Fukushima, what happened, it wasn't just a negative hit to sentiment, which it certainly was. But Japan shut down all of their reactors. They had 54 reactors. They pulled all of them offline. And that was 10% of global demand that was gone, not overnight, but within a number of months. Germany shut down half of their reactors over the next couple of years. And so we ended up having this oversupplied market. So you had all of these producers come online when we had that positive price environment. Yeah. And we had entities like Kazatomprom or Kazakhstan that had been ramping production. They were 100% state-owned at the time, and they were all about grabbing market share, global market share. Doesn't matter the price. And it just so happened they could produce at very low cost, which they still can. But their motivation... They had
about $15 a pound. Is that about right?
It depends on the mine. Some are lower than that. Some are a bit higher. But that's the cash cost. So if you actually take not even the all-in sustaining cost, but the fully allocated cost where you're actually calculating in the dividend that they pay, et cetera. Okay. They're in, you know, the 30 to 35, maybe even slightly higher at this point with inflation and supply chain constraints, but they're definitely the lowest cost producer in the world. BHP, they have a mine called Olympic Dam in Australia, where they produce primarily copper and gold, and uranium is kind of a bonus. So they just sell it at whatever price. So they could be considered the cheapest producer. But Kazakhstan is the 500-pound gorilla in the room. So they were ramping production all through the years. When the price kept falling, they kept increasing their production. And so all of this overproduction created hundreds of millions of pounds of excess in the market. A lot of that went to China, some of it did not, and it took a number of years to work through that. And so when we're talking about the marginal cost of supply of production, what you're taking is like a structural snapshot of the amount of product, the amount of supply that's consumed in a year, and the amount of in the production that would need to balance that out. So for example, this year, we have about 185 million pounds of uranium that will be consumed in reactors globally, and we'll have about 135 million pounds of uranium produced. So, perfect. Yeah, that's a 50 million pound deficit. Now, there is some secondary supply that comes from something called underfeeding, where the enrichers have excess capacity. It's a long story, but they put in maybe 10 to 15 million pounds of secondary supply into the market every year. But either way, then you consider, okay, well, that's the primary production. What's the next tier of mines that could come online and at what cost? So now we're sitting at about $45 a pound uranium. You have Cameco's MacArthur River and Paladin's Langerheinrich. These are kind of the two biggest mines that are on care and maintenance that are likely to come online in the next 2-3 years. So Cameco needs probably around $50 a pound at this point. Paladin probably around 55, 60. So that gets us. That's another 25 million pounds, let's say. So now we're looking at about 160. We still got 25 million pounds structural deficit. What are the next mines that come online and at what price? And so once we get into that marginal cost of production to get us to that balance point, we're looking at about $75 a pound, maybe even more at this point with the rate of inflation and all of the things that are happening with supply chains and labor shortages, et cetera. So now we're sitting at $45 a pound. We need 75, 80. And that's the minimum. That's the minimum that the price will need to go to in the coming years to eventually get to a balanced market. And of course, there's so many other factors at play that we will see a price overshoot, because it'll be driven not by these basic supply demand fundamentals, but it'll be driven by inventory restocking by the utilities. So just looking at supply and demand, you're taking a structural snapshot. You're not taking, it's not a real world view of the stocking that utilities will need to do to build their coffers for producing energy out towards the end of the decade. Then you take financial demand. You have financial players such as the physical trust, the physical funds, hedge funds, even non-producing, you know, development companies buying uranium, et cetera. And so all of these factors come into play to say that with the sector growing, with nuclear buildouts growing pretty quickly, China's nuclear capacity grew by 13% in the past 2 years. They've got 18 reactors under construction. They're planning to build 150 in the next 14 years. Wow. It's just the growth trajectory is pretty great. It's 2-4% per year for the next 15 plus years. On top of these supply demand fundamentals and the financial players taking a pretty big role in the market, you have a scenario that's ripe for a very, very strong run in this particular commodity.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, okay. I like that a lot. I just learned a lot in the last 3 minutes. So we can bet on this in several different ways, correct? We can actually bet physically. We can buy the uranium. Then this is not something we're going to store at home like we would gold. This is something you have to pay an entity to do this for us, but, you know, so it doesn't, you don't lose your hair. The way I personally bet on it, was through SPUT, the, Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. The ticker codes on that are U.U, U.UN, and SR, is it SRUUF?
Yep.
The one that, we got to get in the United States. Okay, so that's a way we could physically bet on it. We could bet ETFs, and we could also bet on mining and exploration companies, correct?
Correct, yep.
Okay, what are your thoughts on, let's take the risk factor from the least risky to the most risky. Would that be the order? Would it be physical, then ETFs, and then mining? Or
I would agree. Yeah, and then there's degrees of risk within the mining companies, obviously.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. If they're not actually producing and they're still looking for it, that's pretty risky.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. What now, as far as physical demand, do you think that's the best one? Is the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, or are there others that might be better?
There's two primary physical equities that you can invest in, and the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust is the largest and the most liquid, and is likely to be the largest, most liquid going forward. The other one is Yellow Cake PLC, and they're traded on the London Stock Exchange. And so if you have access to the LSE, then that's a good option. It's a perfectly, good stock to invest in as well. It's not going to have the liquidity that Sprott has, but it's sufficient for most investors. And generally speaking, both of these physical funds, or in Sprott's case, a trust, will pretty closely track the price of the commodity for the most part. They will both trade at decent premiums and discounts to their net asset value, from time to time. But for the most part, the trend of these stocks will follow the price of the commodity. Sprott is, they're trading currently right around NAV. And so a lot of times when you see a discount to NAV that's pretty substantial, you'll see it's a good opportunity to buy it, and kind of even just play an arbitrage on that discrepancy between their net asset value. But of course, in my opinion, that's by far the least risky play in the entire space, is buying physical through either of these equities. The downside here is extremely minimal. We're sitting at $45 a pound. I would be surprised if we ever see 30s a pound again in this bull market. It would surprise me. I mean, it's ticking down right now, but I don't think that's going to last very long. So even if we did, then what are we talking about? A 15% downside, 20% maybe at the most. And the upside is 2x probably minimum. Yeah. So 15% downside, 100% upside. And of course, the chance and the likelihood of an overshoot in the price of uranium is pretty high. So we could see a 3x, maybe even a 4x in that equity over the, let's say, a 2 to 4 year period of time, but the downside is minimal and the liquidity is great. So by far lowest risk investment in the uranium space.
Okay. So if a newcomer to this is, let's say he puts $4,000 into a Sprott, if uranium goes where we think it's going to go, that may be worth $7,000, $7,500 kind of when it gets to that price. Is that a way of thinking of it, or?
Yeah. And it's also just, it's a good anchor for a portfolio with exposure to uranium because of its liquidity and its relative risk, its relative safety in terms of risk reward. No investment is safe, not investment advice, but just the sheer liquidity and the fact that it's going to track the commodity and the downside is minimal makes it a very safe play.
Now, as far as the ETFs, what are your thoughts on, maybe instead of prefacing it, what do you think are some really good ones out there?
I really like URNM, and that ticker is going to stay the same, even though Sprott is taking that over next month. Well, the shareholder vote is next month, but it's more than likely to pass. So that will become the Sprott Uranium Miners ETF starting in late February or early March. And it's the largest pure play ETF. There's another one called Horizons. It's HURA, and that's traded on the TSX, whereas URNM is traded on the American, the NYSE. So URNM is going to have the most liquidity in terms of being a pure play. URA is still the largest ETF in the uranium space, but they aren't a pure uranium play. So URNM is going to have more exposure to uranium itself, and it has outperformed URA. URA has the most liquidity, so it's still a substantial factor in terms of being a means of big money coming into the space, and And the ETFs, of course, when money piles into the ETFs increase their outstanding shares and buy the underlying holdings. And so that's something that really supports and hurts the sector, depending on the direction of the money flow. Yeah. But for the past year and a half, the share issuance has been so much greater than the share redemptions. So even during these pullbacks, we've had very little in terms of redemptions in the ETFs when they actually decrease their outstanding shares and have to sell down their holdings. That's happened a little bit, but the upside effect, the upside flywheel effect from the ETFs has been so much greater. And of course, that's, you know, if you want uranium exposure without having to do a lot of research into the space, and you want something that's, yes, it's safer, but it's still uranium. So there's still a lot of volatility. It's safer because of the liquidity of the ETFs. And you also have listed options for both URNM and URA. The options market is much deeper for URA. So that's a prime way to play the options market for uranium is through URA. But yeah, those are both good ETFs. URNM would be my go-to if I was going to invest in an ETF in the uranium space.
Yeah, since I did my video on uranium and yellowcake, I kind of like URNM better than URA, and like some of his top holdings are the biggest ones, the biggest guys in the business, you know. And so what are the implications when Sprott takes over this ETF? What do you think that means as far as our average viewer is going to buy this and probably hold it for years? You know, we're our average viewer is not going to be doing the options market, you know.
Right. Well, the implications are basically, so for your listeners and viewers who aren't familiar, Sprott is an absolute powerhouse in the resource space. They manage, what do they have? I think 14 billion under assets under management for their physical trust alone. So that's platinum, palladium, gold, silver, and uranium now. They have a huge, huge reach in the space and a massive client base of institutional investors. So what's happening currently is they have this Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, which, by the way, the application for them to have a New York Stock Exchange listing is underway. And so we're expecting that in Q3. And now they're taking over URNM, which is the largest pure play uranium ETF in the space. And so they're going to have this, I don't want to call it a suite of products because it'll really be just two, but they'll have this means for large investors to have two highly liquid vehicles to gain exposure to uranium, promoted and owned by Sprott, that one will, let's say they were to take, an institutional investor were to take a position, a sizable position in URNM or the Sprott Uranium Miners ETF that it will be known as in a couple of weeks, and then pile into SPUT. And what will happen is the money coming into the Sprott Physics Uranium Trust will allow them to buy physical uranium. So what they do is they'll either do a block trade off market where they'll actually sell shares and raise cash to a large entity, or when the money is flowing through the open market, if they're trading at a greater than 1% premium to NAV, then they'll actually issue shares into the market day over day through their at the market financing, their ATM vehicle. And they can issue shares up to 50 to 60% of the daily trading volume when they're at a greater than 1% premium to NAV. So they've raised, on a single day, they've raised $90 million, over $90 million in one day through the ATM. That's a big volume day when they're at a premium to NAV. And that money literally and physically goes to buy uranium. And what happens when you have substantial buying of uranium in the spot market, it moves the price up. And so you have this like dual flywheel where you can park some money in the ETF and gain exposure to the miners. And then you park some money in SPUT and you buy physical. That moves the price up. That moves the equities up. And so they're going to have this dual entity means of giving their clients extremely highly liquid exposure to uranium. And that's what's going to happen. I mean, that's what they're setting up. They've been working on this deal for a long time. So it took them 3 years to take over Uranium Participation Corporation and create the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. 3 years they worked on that deal. John Cimpaglia, the CEO of Sprott, this is his baby. He was personally working on this. And once they had an understanding of the physical reality of the physical uranium market, then they understood the opportunity for, you know, moving the price with these purchases. And yeah. So the implications essentially have to do with who Sprott is, their marketing capabilities, their client base, and the fact that they will be able to offer an ETF and a physical vehicle simultaneously is really, you know, that's kind of the reading the tea leaves there, I guess.
Yeah. It's getting me very excited.
Yeah.
Okay. So going up the risk ladder a little bit here, or actually probably quite a bit, as far as mining, you know, you mentioned Kazatomprom in Kazakhstan. You know, as far as I understand it, they produce about a fifth of the world's uranium supply every year. Is that about right?
Kazatomprom, yes. Their nameplate capacity is more. So the total production that comes out of Kazakhstan is more like 46%. But Kazatomprom as a company is about half of that. So yeah, it's more like 20, almost 25%.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Cameco, Paladin, like what are some, if, okay, let's say our average viewer is sold on Sprott, they're sold on URNM. What are a couple little leveraged, you know, exponential plays that they could put in as far as the mining sector?
Sure. Well, I mean, if you're going after individual miners, like you mentioned Kazatomprom, I don't know if I would call that leveraged because it is a larger company, but as far as if you're looking at an actual value play, there's very little to choose from in the uranium space because so few companies are producing or are expected to produce. So in terms of actually doing, you know, like discounted cash flow analysis on a company, Kazatomprom is one of a small handful that you can even do that type of analysis with. And they are by far, relative to their current cash flow and projected cash flow with a uranium price where we're expecting it to go, is a cheap company. It's just a large cap. So the moves are a little bit slightly muted relative to the juniors, but it's a safer play and they are producing something physical and cash, and most companies will never do that in the uranium space. So that's something, that's kind of the first thing to understand, is that it's analysis of the companies in the space is different than, you know, sectors where you can actually analyze cash flow and look at balance sheets. I mean, you can still look at the balance sheets and see how they're managing the money that they're bringing in through private placements, etc. But expected cash flow is, you know, leaves you a half dozen companies out of the 70. So you have Kazatomprom, Cameco is currently producing from their Cigar Lake mine and from their Inkai JV in Kazakhstan. And they obviously have MacArthur River, which is the largest mine in the world, uranium mine in the world, that's on care and maintenance. It's expected to come online during this bull cycle. So at some point, probably in the next 12 months, we expect them to have sufficient term contracts that will tie up future pounds from that mine to allow them to announce that they are bringing it back online. That's a big process. It's going to cost a lot of money, probably close to $100 million to bring that mine back online. They have to hire a lot of staff. It's a very complex mine. So that'll take 12 to 18 months to come back online after they announce that. And then that first year produces 4 million pounds. The second year they get back up to full production, which is more expected, 18 million pounds. So that's a big mine. And Cameco, you know, with the recent unrest that's happened in Kazakhstan, it doesn't look like in the short term that's going to affect Kazatomprom's production. Well, there's not going to be defaults on their deliveries more than likely. However, they are highlighting some supply chain constraints, but there does seem to be some new geopolitical risk there that didn't necessarily exist even weeks ago. So long story short, what's more than likely to happen is utility interest, at least amongst Western utilities, is likely to shift at least ever so slightly away from complete reliance on the East and balance that out with production coming from Canada, coming from Australia, coming from the US. And so Canada or Cameco is likely to be a beneficiary of that. So we're likely to hear about more term contracts being signed with Cameco going forward. And then you have a number of developing companies, companies with mines and care and maintenance, like Paladin. They have Linger Heinrich and Namibia on care and maintenance. Development companies, you have Denison Mines in Canada. That's probably one. If you're looking for something that's kind of leveraged, as you say, they're experimenting with doing ISR mining in the Athabasca Basin of Saskatchewan. So the Athabasca Basin is it's basically a giant underground river, and it's loaded with high grade uranium. And so MacArthur River and Cigar Lake, owned by Cameco and Orano, they have, these mines are underground mines that have something called a freeze wall. They actually have to freeze the water table surrounding the underground mine to access the ore. And it's unbelievably complex. And so what Denison is attempting to do is mine with ISR, which is in situ recovery. It's a series of wells. They inject what's called a lixiviant. It's a fluid that will extract the uranium from the ore. Okay. And then they extract it. So injection extraction wells, and it hasn't been done in the Athabasca yet. And so that's also a pretty complex process, but they have this super high grade deposit called the Phoenix deposit. And they're trying to not only get that improved with the environmental regulations in Saskatchewan, Canada, but also just prove that it's a viable option. So when you say leverage, I think that that's one that could work out well, especially if they can pull that off. That's a big win for that company. Yeah.
Interesting. What do you think of Paladin?
Paladin, it's been a really strong stock. The Aussies are very enthusiastic resource investors, I've come to find out. I didn't want to touch the Australian stocks during the bear market because they just, the CEOs just think that shares grow on trees, and they just issue them like crazy. Most of the Aussie stocks are penny stocks with shares in the billions.
They just like, dilute the crap out of them.
I don't like it. But once the sector turns and the money comes into the space, the dilution is far less on a relative basis. And like I said, the ASX resource investors are one of a kind. It's been a very strong stock. In fact, in the past 6 months, I would say the ASX uranium stocks have outperformed the TSX and the NYSE. So in Paladin, they have Linger Heinrich. It's a mine that will come back into production. They actually have 25%25% of the company is owned by the Chinese, and they have an offtake from that mine, and they're getting pressure from their Chinese co-owners to bring the mine on now and do it sooner, because they want to get that uranium. The Chinese they're growing their nuclear fleet like crazy. So that's a mine that will come back online. It's a large cap. It has good liquidity. You know, a lot of people, it has good name recognition because it was a great performer in the previous bull market. Is it going to do a 20X from here? No, it's not, but it'll do well. It has done well. It will continue to perform.
Okay. One other question on URA. Now, pretty soon here, they're going to be putting the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust inside their list of bets, right? Inside their ETF.
That's the expectation.
Okay. What's the timeline on that? A couple of months or?
The rebalance is happening right now. It started this week. And so, okay. So URA rebalances twice a year, and that's late January and late July. And what they'll do is they'll cut any stocks that have fallen below their market cap or liquidity requirements. They'll add any companies that have that are now in line with those requirements or are meeting those requirements in terms of market cap and liquidity. And then they also do rebalancing amongst their holdings. The outperformers get cut a little bit, the underperformers add, and any new additions get added. And so what's happening now is, so even just a few months ago, it was understood that URA was not going to allow the ownership of trusts within the ETF. Now that language was just amended less than a month ago. And so we believe it was amended for the purpose of including the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. And they should have somewhere, and the trust will have a 10% maximum weight within that ETF. So it'll be somewhere between 7 and 10%. And what they'll have to do is sell down their other holdings to raise the cash and make the room for that addition. That's one reason why.
Yeah, because they don't have 10% cash right now. It's all tied up in,
correct,
in
companies. Correct.
So what are your thoughts on the implication of when that transition happens?
Well, short term, it's painful because it's adding selling pressure to the whole sector.
Yeah.
So that's one reason why the sector is a bit weak right now. Long term, it's fantastic. That adds yet another flywheel to the whole sector. It's just 10%, up to 10% of the money that comes into the ETF when they issue shares will go towards buying SPUT, which, assuming they're at a premium to NAV and assuming that they're issuing shares into the market, 50 to 60% of that money goes literally to buying physical uranium. So never before has money going into URA led to buying physical, and now it will. It's a really, really big deal. And it's very good for the financial speculation of the sector. I would not argue that it's great for the nuclear fuel sector and great for the utilities necessarily, but it's good for the investing speculation on there. And one note I should add is on the rebalance, Solactive, which manages URA, all of their ETFs, they are divesting of BHP, and BHP is a massive, massive mining company. The only uranium that they deal in, to my understanding, is in that Olympic Dam mine that I mentioned. But so they're selling out of BHP, and they had about $20 million position in BHP. So that helps to offset the rest of the selling that would have had to happen in the uranium, in their other uranium holdings to make room for SPUT. So that definitely helps, but there's still some selling pressure that's happening now and will continue to happen. The rebalance typically takes about 2 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. BHP's done quite a run in the last week and a half or so. It's been kind of nice. Well, maybe a little bit longer than that. Maybe.
Right.
But yeah. Okay. And we get a nice little dividend once a year with the URA and URNM, and nothing with the SPUT and some of the mining companies too. Right.
Right. Yeah. SPUT doesn't issue a dividend. You actually have to pay to own it. I think with 0.3% or something like that.
0.35 is the last.
Yeah. So. The management fee. Yeah.
I guess it costs to store nuclear.
It does. Stuff in a
warehouse.
It's there's free. It's stored at conversion facilities, and there is a cost to it. So yeah.
Okay. So how can my viewers get a hold of you? Uraniuminsider.com.
Yep, that's our website. I'm on Twitter pretty frequently, so I can be reached there or interacted with there. And then I also do a almost daily podcast on YouTube that's called the Uranium Market Minute. And I just speak briefly on what I'm seeing in the sector kind of on a day-to-day basis, because there's so much happening in this space. It's so convoluted and opaque and volatile that there's always something to speak on. And even when things are quiet, I kind of get into investing psychology and stuff like that. So that's been a fun process. And so that's pretty much, you know, what we do at Uranium Insider is try to distill down all of these moving parts into what it means to you as an investor. And that's the primary objective of the newsletter, which goes out. We do a newsletter every month. It's once a month. It's about a 30 to 40 page newsletter. And then we do intra-month bulletins based on new positions, selling positions, actionable news that comes into the sector. We just sold out of an option spread position that we've been holding for about 7 months. Pretty well. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That was a URA option spread. So we did pretty well on that. And then we do monthly members only webinars, and those have been super fun. Those allow us to go really in depth. We typically have a guest from one of the companies that we own join us on the webinars, and then we just geek out on the whole sector and get really deep into the individual companies, do some Q&A. We usually have a pretty good turnout to those. So that's always fun too.
Deal. Good deal. Okay. We'll throw your link in the show notes, and thank you for coming on, Justin. This was a lot of fun. We'll have to do it again.
It's my pleasure. Yeah. Nice speaking with you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
All right. You too. Take care.
Cheers.